Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, Ada.
Kelvin, we are continuing this exploration of mathemusics, which is my attempt to help people understand that in healthcare, we should look at the foundations of what health is. And Bert Vervain helped understand that we should look for cell communication. The continuous cell communication makes it possible for all the cells to exchange molecules. In fact, it's a way in which the internal cell cycle has an external circulation loop. So we have internal cycles, we have external cycles. So I was looking for a way to understand how these internal cycles, external cycles, like lemniscate, like Möbius loops, all connect up. And I realized that one of the clearer languages that we have for cycles within cycles is mathemusics. And then you and I started to talk about your work on tetrionics. And at some point, I asked you if you would be willing to think along on how you look at those cell cycles from the perspective of tetrionics. And we have already gone into a wonderful detail of how, with the language of tetrionics, which you found, which you created, you are able to look at all these cell cycles and the cycles within cycles in a different manner. And from that perspective, you've created a series of very clear pictures of triangles, because the basis of tetrionics is the quantum, which is represented as a triangle having both electrical and magnetic properties. And out of that, tetrionic then shows that it is the basis of electromagnetic fields. It is also the basis of what we know as matter. And all of it is basically founded on these equilateral triangles with their internal circulation, the rotational momentum, with their unitary unit of change, a linear momentum. And from that perspective, you then connect that into mathemusics, which has already led to a very clear imaging of how musical scales connect, how the atomic spectra and the cellular dynamics, the cellular symphonies, all connect up. And in the last session, we were talking about the way these atomic energies and the cell energies work, but that there is also that principle of cellular inversion, which is a cell rotating on itself, which is the foundation of cell divisions, decisions, could be modeled in the approach of tetrionics by the concept of a vortex. The concept of the vortex is very fundamental. And one of the very nice descriptions of that is in the work of Lawrence Edwards, who wrote a book with the title The Vortex of Life. He does a very neat representation of something turning inside out on itself. He actually starts with a line turning inside out on itself through a point, and then he shows that when you draw that movement by the geometry which it represents, you can see that there is a relationship between a vortex, the shape of the egg, the shape of a torus, and Dan Winter also shows that you can then connect it up to many star shapes, layers within layers. So the vortex of life is a very fundamental concept. Basically, that old idea of the cosmic egg is encapsulated within that. The torus, or the smoke ring, the donut, the shape, the wave shape that will perpetuate itself, is essential in that. And the vortex, of course, is something which is very fundamental in the universe as a whole. Anybody who ever filled a bathtub with water and then pulled the plug will see that the water flows out in the shape of a vortex. So in the vortex, there is that relationship between the three-dimensional volume of the bath, the two-dimensional surface of the bath, which that dimples in, with a one-dimensional flow line going towards the sink, and the sink point itself, which is in zero dimensions. So there is this explicit relationship between three-dimensional, two-dimensional, one-dimensional, and zero-dimensional spaces in one unified system. For me, that has always been a core point in understanding how cells communicate. Cell divisions can actually be seen as the volume of the cell in the physical space, going back to the chemical interaction, which of course takes place at the surface of the molecule, which is a planar interaction, and then goes into the core of the atom, where of course it will be an internal transition. So there too we see that relation between three-dimensional, two-dimensional, one-dimensional, and then in phase space outside of the physical realm altogether, the zero-dimensional, the wave division bounces back producing two cells. And in the previous episode of Mathemusics, I already said that that is a very fundamental concept, and with what you had just talked about, the relationship of the triangles in that whole change of activity in cells, which then came up as the relationship between the spiral and the linear momentum, then of course made me curious as to how it would be possible to understand what happens one dimension further when we go from the spiral to the vortex. And then you say, well, that is very simple, because it is essentially the same. All that is needed is to look at it in a different way, to see how everything that already is understood in tetrionics at the level of the spiral can then be understood at the level of the vortex. And that's where I say, well, Kelvin, that would be great if you would explain that a bit, because there are so many people who in healthcare do not see as yet that the vortex is at the foundation of every change, where anything turns inside out, which of course is always happening whenever anything crosses a boundary. And as in the universe, every part is connected to the whole by the boundary, then the singularity of the boundary, which is where the part and the whole actually do connect, is also an inversion point where the part is the inverse of the universe. And that is also where I see that the cell is the universe in inverse. So it would really help to have a modeling in tetrionics of that so very fundamental concept. And as you said, well, that's really simple. That's where they say, well, yeah, please, let's talk about that. Because a lot of people don't even know that the vortex is foundation of health. People know that the chakras, people know that the cell divisions, it's also found in cell fusions. The whole basis of health and healthcare is based on cells being in balance in what happens before cell division and what happens after cell division, which you could also say that what happens on the inside must balance what happens on the outside. So basically that the one side of the vortex and the other side of the vortex are always connected. When you pull the plug in the bath, the vortex which disappears into a sewer system is actually also the vortex which reconnects the water back into the oceans and the universal circulation of water in the atmosphere. And there with my question, can you please talk a bit more about the way tetrionics makes it possible to describe that and to understand that?
Yeah, sure. The two simple points I want to make at the start is as you said, tetrionics is all about these triangles and how these triangles explain all the physics, all the matter, the mass, and the physics of motion in our universe. As you get more familiar with tetrionics, you become more and more accustomed to the fact that the explanation that nature, or the mechanics that nature uses, explained by the tetrionic geometries, are really just a very, very simple geometry. And from that geometry, we get all our complex shapes and topologies and mathematics. They all flow from these simple arrangements of triangles. The hardest part for people trying to understand tetrionics is trying to wrap their head around the mechanics that these simple geometries make. And we'll touch on that as we progress through these few illustrations. And you'll see just how simple but how radical the change is. We've all got our own mental images and the ways of explaining these vortexes and these spirals, both mathematically and visually. They've been drummed in our heads for years, black holes or water spiraling down the bathtub, tornadoes, all these sorts of things. As I alluded to last night, there's a simple relationship between spirals and vortexes. And the simplest way to explain that relationship is that a spiral is a 2D map of a 3D vortex. Now, you can see that in the first illustration, illustration 820, spiral vortices, where there's a spiral in the middle, which starts off large, comes down in its conical shape, which everyone's familiar with for a vortice. So it creates this spiral motion, creates the vortex that we're familiar with, and they always funnel towards this point singularity, as I've called it. Now, it might be the drain hole of a plug in a bathtub. It could be the center of a black hole or the center of a galaxy. Where physics, in particular the mathematics of physics, has gone wrong yet again is that where we have these sorts of fields, or any sort of field that radiates out from a point source, whether it's a singularity or not, it may be a particle. Where these fields of force radiate out, we measure the forces at various points in space. And we use that to map these field strengths. Now, the fields themselves are scalar fields. Tetrionics, you can see the two illustrations of the tetrionic fields for an explosion and an implosion at the top of the page. It's just the same energy momenta, except one points outwards, one points inwards towards the point singularities or the point sources. But within that field, physics will take a measurement, and it will measure the strength of that field and the direction of the field, the vector direction. And then it draws the diagrams based on that. Now, you might draw a vector diagram, like on the left-hand side, which all the forces point outwards or inwards, depending whether it's an explosion or an implosion. All the forces point in or out towards this central source that's either emanating the force or funneling the force, or funneling the motion, more appropriately, because the force will be applied from outside. We map either the vector forces, or alternatively, we can release, observe an object or release an object into that same spatial region or spatial volume and track its motion. In which case, for example, here we've released pink balls into the region of space. And those pink balls follow a path. Now, in this case, because it's an implosion or explosion, they're spiral paths as viewed from the top of the system, looking down, whereas the energy fields at the top of the page are side views of that same thing. So if you like, the pink linear momentum arrows that you see in that bottom left hand illustration pointing out are in fact the pink photons that you can see in those two top energy momenta fields, where obviously the linear momentum is the square root of the scalar energies, mv versus mv squared. So there's your first point of distinction from what we've grown accustomed to, and that is that these pink arrows where we draw the vector forces don't show us the equilateral triangles of energy. And we've discussed that before, the triangles of energy are in fact more or less hidden from our view because we're looking straight down from the top of them. They're only two-dimensional objects, fields of energy momenta. They can exert a force, but they have no third dimension to give us any material substance to them. So they're the radiant fields of energy momenta that create force. As the diagram, as the illustration says, vortices form, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a spiral or a vortex itself, two dimension versus three, same thing, one's a map of the other. They form whenever radiant vector sources have or produce forces from them or towards them that change over time. So if these forces didn't change, say it was an atom radiating energy or a star radiating energy, to give you the two extremes. If it was a constant radiation of energy, that force would radiate out equally with the same strength in all directions. And what would be produced would be a circular path. The same with a musical tone. A constant sound pressure radiated in all direction produces a constant note when listened to from all directions. Same physics applies, same geometry applies. If we were, instead of to look at the polar view of that vortex, if we were then to rotate our perspective to the side view of that same vortex, you'd see what is on the right-hand side of the page. And that is, instead of a spiral spiraling in or spiraling out, you'd have, for lack of a better word, a series of concentric rings. As you take your, say it was measured over 10 seconds in this case, every time you measured the motion or the vector forces at a point in space, you would map this spiral pattern spiraling down towards a point singularity. Now, we'll go into the discussion of how point singularities vary from the common understanding of them in the next illustration. Just bear with me. When we move on to the next illustration, 821, we look specifically at the spirals, both at the polar view and the side view again. But in this time, we're looking at it and we're color-coding those vector forces in terms of the strength of the energy momenta. So we've color-coded them just to highlight that they're a changing value all the way through. And again, if there was an object placed that force interacted with over time, it would cause that body or that object to spiral in as the strength got weaker and weaker. So Newton was the first one to talk about changing forces, and particularly he defines force in his second law of Newton's laws, which is force equals mass times acceleration, where the acceleration is the change of the linear momentum, either of the system or of the object. Now, just as we've described here yet again, you can have the perspective of the object radiating force out with its associated energy momenta. The object that we model, whose motion we map, also has a linear, or more appropriately, an angular momentum associated with it. So we could map even its angular momentum and have no idea about the source. Just track the object and its motion, and we see that it follows a curved path, forever spiraling in this case, or moving outwards. Well, actually, in this case, it's moving outwards. As it moves out, it starts with a strong force that gives it the angular motion, and then it spirals outwards, getting weaker as it travels further away from the source point. Because bearing in mind that most of these energy momenta fields, that they're electromagnetic, bar gravity, but all the others are electromagnetic, and they're all subject, as is gravity, to the inverse squared law. So they all taper off as the square of the distance. So looking at the side view of that same one where we color-coded the linear momentum that's radiated out to create that pattern of motion, we can then look at it from the side view and you see the same thing. You can see the vector forces radiating out at each and every step. Now, coincidentally, well, not so coincidentally, that's also very similar to the original model for the electron orbitals in atoms. And you'll see why shortly as to how that comes about. But when Newton described the accelerations as changes of linear momentum, you can break that down further and express the changing linear momentum as delta mv divided by time. So there's a time component. If you don't have a time component, all you can measure is an object or a force at a particular point in the field. You can't measure the next one because you can't progress to the next unit of time. In order to locate that object or that measure that force again, in order to join the two or more dots together to create the spiral pattern or to map the physical topology of the vortice. Now, obviously, the left-hand sides of the spirals I spoke about, they're two-dimensional. They give us some information about the forces and the direction and the strength of the forces. But they're lacking that three-dimensional component. The right-hand side gives us that three-dimensional component or mapping, which matches up with the vortices. So from those vector arrows of linear momentum or vector arrows of force, we can modify that picture of a water spout or a water funnel just slightly to draw linear momentum as a measure from one side of the funnel to the other. So that's the force that's holding that funnel out of that shape. And we then measure time as the vertical axis up and down. So as we move up and down, we're moving through time, taking different measurements of either the linear momentum forces that hold that funnel out, and obviously has to increase and decrease in accord with the shape of the vortice. And in tetrionics, we define time completely different to how physics at present does. Physics at present weaves time into space, becomes space-time in relativity, where space-time is curved and that creates the motion. We can see quite clearly from these illustrations, space-time isn't curved. Time is just a linear up and down from the source outward or outward towards the source, convergent or divergent. But it's always a positive. You don't have negative time. The concept of negative time is a reflection, again, that the mathematics doesn't understand what they're describing in physics. Time as a measure of a system or a physical system in tetrionics is defined as the change in quantized angular momentum per planar region. Now, again, that linear momentum as we discussed here is just a two-dimensional slice. There's no three-dimensional component to linear momentum. They're the square root of 2D fields of energy. They're a vector force, a 1D vector force within two-dimensional energy. And the two-dimensional energy is just a slice of a three-dimensional topology. In this case, so you have a one-dimensional vector force, two-dimensional energies, which are normally hidden from view because they're rotated 90 degrees from our view in the illustrations. And then you have the three-dimensional funnels that these vortices create. The quantized angular momentum that's changing per c squared is the geometry of energy itself. In tetrionics, we define quantized angular momentum as the equilateral geometry of Planck's constant. Planck's constant has units of mass, or kilograms, square meters per second, which is mass omega, which is mass dot QAM. Omega is Omega is a angular momentum. In this case, it's the quantum or the quantized angular momentum of a system or of energy itself. It's what you what you get when you divide energy by the frequency. Energy of a photon divided by Planck's constant is a frequency. Energy of a boson divided by Planck's constant is nu. It's a quanta. So the Planck's constant itself written as H is better rewritten as mass omega or mass QAM, which is ties it in with what it is. And when you read mass QAM or mass omega, you just think equilateral mass energies. It's the geometry of Planck's constant itself. So what that then says to us is if you divide square meters per second by the c squared, or in other words, multiply by the indicative, the multiplicative indicative inverse, you would get square meters per second multiplied by squared seconds per meter squared. And that gives you an answer of seconds. It's a simple bit of algebra. Anyone can do it. So you then have seconds, so delta QAM divided by C squared, and that should be divide, not multiplied, by the way, in that illustration. Divided by C squared is delta seconds. Delta seconds, changing seconds, is how we measure time. Simple as that. Time is a measure of the changing seconds, the elapsed seconds that we measure, and that can only be measured when you have changing Planck geometries. In this case, you would have a change from one energy level to the next. In the spiral, as we've said, you're going from, say, a red to an orange, so there must be a change of energies, to a yellow, which again has the change of energies, because if they were all red, you'd just have a series of red circles, not a spiral, and you'd have a cone. And it would be impossible to detect any change because there is no changing energy momenta. Momenta is what gives you motion. Energy gives you the momentum, I should say. So you need the changing energies to create the changing physical forces. So without that delta, without time, you can't measure accelerations, spirals inward or outward, and you certainly can't map a vortex by taking a snapshot of the vortex at any one instant, because it would just be like a photograph. It appears to be frozen in time. So without changing quantized angular momentum or energy momentum specifically, you cannot map change physical systems. They just appear as a instantaneous snapshot of the system, and all you can derive from that information is what particles are involved and their current position. You cannot determine anything about their motions or where the forces for those motions come from. So this definition of time as changing energy geometries is critical. And in fact, the next extension would be to say, well, what if QAM is part of Planck's constant, what is changing mass QAM, or changing Planck's constant in a system? And the answer is simple. It goes from from seconds to mass seconds. Mass seconds is the SI units of charge in physics, unrealized because they're so busy with far more complicated SI units, but they all boil down to mass seconds. So in some respects, where mass is concerned, not energy, but where mass is concerned, delta QAM or delta Planck's constant gives us charge at the quantum level. We're not worried so much about the charge here. We're worried about the changing energy, the vector energy, scalar energies, because it's the scalar energies that produce the vector forces that create the 2D spirals that map the 3D vortexes. In illustration 8.2.2, you can see a whole series of differing spirals in nature as they're found. As we said, the, spirals are found in lots and lots of places. And in fact, lots of physics describe things as vortices, black holes, wormholes, energy and matter spirals into the black hole to vanish from our universe and go magically somewhere else. This is where analogies with mathematics goes astray. Because even though that the mathematics can produce the spirals and the vortexes, they don't explain what is going on. Tetrionics does. In that first illustration that we started with, we had the explosive and implosive fields of energy momenta. In both cases, irrespective of which direction the fields, the energy momenta was propagating, we had a point singularity. And that, simply put, is the region where the electromagnetic field and the energy momenta come to a zero point, where either the electric fields reverse their polarity, the magnetic fields reverse their dipoles, where the energy, in the case of an implosive, will reduce right down to zero. These are mysterious in mathematics, even though they're well known, because all mathematics can do is follow these lines back to their point source. The quantum mechanics of what happens at that point source is completely unknown to modern physics. Not so with tetrionics, but completely unknown to modern physics, because at the scale of an atom, they have no idea what's creating these forces, say that it's an electron, for example, and the electron's energy is changing, or the atom's energy is changing, causing the electron to spiral one direction or the other within the atom, or to jump from one energy level to the other. But as to the actual structure and electrodynamics and mechanics that create those forces, they have no idea. And particularly where you have a case where the field forces come to a point, i.e. inside a magnet or inside an electromagnetic field, where the electric fields cross a zero point and either change the electric polarity or change the magnetic polarity, they can't explain the dynamics that are occurring there, other than to say there's this point where everything reverses. And this gets worse in the case of a black hole, because the theory holds that in black holes, matter is sucked into a black hole. Nothing, not even light, can escape a black hole. So therefore, all the matter that goes in must be transported somewhere magically at this crossover point, at the point singularity. And the only explanation that the current mathematical models and the mental thought experiments and extrapolations from those mathematical models and graphs can give us is that they must go to another dimension. Well, in tetrionics, as you can see there in that first illustration, that does not happen. It's simply a crossover point for the field geometries of the electric and magnetic scalar fields. And the fields cross over, they change from one polarity to the other quite easily and quite happily. There is no mystical other dimension. Wormholes, black holes, all this sort of stuff doesn't exist. Just like the spiral you see in illustration 822, you have energy spiraling in from one direction and spiraling out of the other. This is what brought up the ideas of wormholes. They would travel through the black hole or the wormhole, through the point singularity, and then magically appear somewhere else in another universe or at another. In the case of a wormhole, it was bending space-time, which we've discussed doesn't exist, to create this shortcut through space and time. Time is not connected to space. Time is connected to changing energy geometries. Space is the container of nothing into which energy is poured, and that energy that's poured via its charge, its delta Planck quanta, and which creates time, delta omega, or delta QAM, that creates, the charge creates the mass energy geometries, the matter topologies, and the changing energy momenta that creates the fields of motion, the forces of motion for everything in the galaxy. So not just spirals and vortexes, but vector lines, as we've discussed, and the law of attraction and repulsion. The gravitation is created through all these forces and all this energy. If you take all the electromagnetic energy out of space, there is no time, and all you're left with is space. It's just space. Time only comes into existence once you have energy within space, and it's certainly not curved by the presence of matter or the motion of matter or the strength of the energy. It's the changing energy geometries that create this, our ability to sense and measure time and to measure physics for that matter. So you can see in 822 we've got a whole series of different illustrations. We've got water spot vortices, we've got cone shells, we've got galaxies. They all produce various spirals and various vortices. You can see the physical vortices. You can see them, you can map them as spirals moving down from polar views and side views, as we've just discussed. And there's a whole series. They're not just plain spirals, as we've discussed, simple spirals, but you can, there's a list there. You can have hyperbolics, you can have logarithmics, you can have spirals that follow the Fibonacci sequence, and that's particularly prominent in nature, the Fibonacci sequence, because again, as we've discussed, that's simply how much energy a organism has to expend to continue to grow a shell or to develop petals. It's a natural progression of how much you can pack into a space. It must be expended to continue to grow that shape in these patterns. So these spirals can follow many, many, many mathematical patterns, but the maths and the patterns reveal nothing about the dynamics of these spirals, as we've done here. That they don't reveal that the point sources are simply a crossover point. They're just simply where the electric and magnetic fields cross. There is no magical sinkhole to another universe. Doesn't exist. Doesn't even apply. It's a poor extrapolation of a known physical reality to a mathematical model in an attempt to explain the mechanics. Tetrionics gets around this problem because we build tetrionics from the ground up. We use Planck energy, equilateral Planck energy momenta, to create charge, or with its charge, to create mass energies, geometries, and to create matter topologies. So we can model exactly what is at the heart of all these spirals, at the point singularity, where modern physics maps the lines of force of electric charge back to an electron. We can draw the physical topology of an electron. We don't draw it as a sphere. And we can explain all its properties, as we've done in previous lectures. All that's covered. And the final illustration rams that point home. Because in 822 periodic elements, I show what the actual charge topology of an atom is. In this case, it's element 120, just to highlight the symmetry that's involved in this case. And to also show that the periodic elements can be mapped via a vortex. Just as we have had the vortex spiraling inward to the point singularity and spiraling back out, the tetrionic periodic atom or nuclei is the opposite. It starts at zero, expands out to starts at the point singularity, expands out to the maximum width of the vortex. Then you have another vortex on top. So it's like two cones put together, or as I describe it, the children's spinning top that everyone's familiar with. that most people have played with except for the current generation. You can see there that the Atom is definitely a spinning top arrangement. What's even more interesting about it is if you look at the number of deuterium nuclei that fill each atomic shell or quantum level, depending whether you're talking Bohr, Bohr notation, or whether you're talking Schrodinger numbers, the number of deuterium nuclei in each atomic shell follows a discrete pattern. And again, it's this double cone, two double conic joined together, two cones joined together. It starts with 2, then 8, then 18, then 32. It reaches the point of singularity and then reverses and then goes 32, 18, 8, and 2. Now, this pattern's not well known for a reason I'll explain very shortly, as is the fact that there's only 120 periodic elements. This is a brand new understanding of the quantum topology of all atomic nuclei. You can see the deuterium nuclei that make up all the positions in that element. But what's unknown is what creates this pattern, 2, 8, 18, 32, 32, 18, 8, 2. At present, physics doesn't know that pattern. It knows 2, 8, 18, 32. It knows there's some numbers on the O level or energy level 5, and there's some elements on energy level 6, and still some on energy level Q. But because they follow the mathematical progression of 2, 8, 18, 32, there are still some textbooks out there. These orbit that the orbitals, I might add, are S, P, D, and F in those shells. There are still textbooks out there that go past orbital F and discuss things like orbital H or G and H and I, because they know no bound. They keep thinking that this spiral, they think of the atom as a spiral with its orbitals. And as you work up 2, 8, 18, 32, or K, L, M, and N, that O must be larger because it's a cone. So then they think, well, the next level, the H, there's possibly another orbital out there which can contain 50. Not 32, but 50. And then possibly another orbital which may even contain 72. So they have no limit on the number of artificial elements that can be made. And that's why they keep trying to make more and more. What they don't realize is that at shell N or level 4, the pattern reverses. And you have a cone that started out and funneled outwards, now funnels back in, to create a symmetry, and nature loves a symmetry. In this case, the symmetry is a material topology. So we end up with this spinning top design. But the other thing that's interesting is that the number of nuclei, or in most cases, the number of electrons that can be held in each of these orbitals, it's a bit of a mystery as to why K level or energy level 1 has 2, the next level has 8, then 18, then 32. There doesn't seem to be a pattern as to why in their spherical pattern packing of protons and neutrons together, why these number of nuclei should pack in those numbers. We can begin to see it from the charge topology that's there. But the interesting thing about those numbers is they're actually 2 times the square of each energy level. 2 is 2 times 1 squared. 8 is 2 times 2 squared. 18 is 2 times 3 squared. 32 is 2 times 4 squared. There's a pattern that even the chemists haven't discovered. And because it then flips around, we then have a reversal. 32 is 2 times 4 squared, and so on, back down to 2 times 1 squared. That's the pattern that's created, and I term that the square of the photonic numbers. Because if you look at the energy levels that are represented both sides of that atom, which are basically either their chem fields or their BEM fields, and these are just changing energy levels again, energy with their square root energy momenta. So as energy is added let's say it's added to the atom, the chem and BEM fields radiate, have more energy momenta to radiate out, so they can create forces around them. When they create these fields of energy momenta around them, when we try to measure them, not only is the atom symmetrical like a top, the electromagnetic field surrounding it that radiates out in all directions like these spirals with energy, same energy in all directions, is measured by our instruments as a spherical halo, because we're just measuring these points of energy or force, and we're coming up with these measurements that draw circles. So we assume that it's a spherical atom. It's not spherical at all. It's a tetrahedral, 4-pi tetrahedral geometry built up from equilateral Planck quanta. But if you look at those fields as they're drawn, you can see that the lowest energy field has 2 Planck quanta, which means that the square root would be 1, pointing in either direction. The next energy level, which has got the 8, would have square root linear momentums of 2 in both directions. The next one is 18, which is 2 times 9. Square root of 9 is 3, so you've got 3 in both directions. And so on and so forth. As you increase the energy, you increase the linear momentum that the particle radiates out that you can detect. Equally, as other these radiant fields with their energy momenta reach out from one particle to the other and communicate the mass, the energy, the charge, the vector direction, the linear momentum of that particle to the other particle. And because the charge information's communicated, the particles know whether they attract each other or repel each other. They know how big one particle is to the other. It's the magical, the mysterious mechanics of nature that Feynman was trying to find when he developed QED. And after he developed QED, he realized that the mathematics couldn't be the way electrons and particles communicate. They communicate through these fields of energy momenta. And these fields produce the spirals, whether it's a physical atom or whether it's a spiral as in a vortex. Again, the same fields are created by stars. They radiate the energy out. The planets are attracted via gravity, drawn towards the planet, and the radiant fields of force that radiate out push out against the planets and keep them in more or less circular orbits. It's not quite circular because sometimes the planet is accelerated a bit, so it moves a bit further away, and that it then slows down as gravity takes over to pull it back in, and that creates a slightly elliptical orbit, but more or less circular all the same. And the sun's output varies over time as well. So if it's a bit weaker, the planet moves in a little bit closer. If it's radiating a bit more, it moves the planet out a little bit more, but we don't tend to notice those variations because most planets are fairly massive. They have a lot of inertial mass in their matter topologies, so they don't react exceedingly fast to those changes. But these spirals are everywhere. But they are not... The point singularities that they funnel towards are not gateways into another dimension. They're not... Wormholes don't exist. Point singularities of electrons don't exist. There are point particles, but there are no... The singularity exists. That's your crossover point. But there is no magical gateway to another dimension, etc. Or another multiverse. If there's a spiral or a vortex in nature, something is draining energy away from that point. It's as simple as that. It's not draining it away to put it somewhere else, etc. And these patterns appear everywhere. But the reason I chose the atom in this case was to show that there's even inverted spirals or inverted vortexes in a physical sense, not just in a immaterial sense, in that we're drawing them. The other interesting thing that you'll pick up from this illustration, which is probably where I'll pull it up, is the fact that we've got two identical fields either side of that atom. If it were the BEM field, for example, any one of those energy levels, you can see the symmetry in those BEM fields. As you add more energy to that field, you create more linear momentum in two directions. So in the case of a cell, a biological cell, it will have a halo or a BEM field of a certain number of Planck quanta, which has a certain energy momenta value. Now that's pulling and pushing in two directions. It's trying to move the cell, in this case in two directions because it's a BEM field. But if there was just a chem field, it would definitely move in one direction, which would be Brownian motion. But in this case, we're talking a bilateral radiation, or many of them. It radiates in all directions. But when it comes to cell mitosis, as evidenced in IVF treatments, when they first developed the IVF treatment, they put the egg in the cell and waited, and nothing happened. Nil, nada. Didn't do a thing. Disappointed them immensely. Drove them to tears trying to figure out what's happening. Then one day, someone applied a very small, I think it was about 5 volt DC spark to the cell with the egg, the fertilized egg, and it split. Why did it split? What was so magical about this 5 volt spark of life? We added more energy momenta to the existing BEM field. The BEM field that was keeping the cell still in its environment suddenly had more energy. The linear momentum of that energy then had more force, because we've changed it. Changing momenta is a force in two directions, was sufficient to divide the cell into two separate fields. It's as simple as that. Add the spark, more forces to push it outwards. The cell then just divides and begins its propagation, so long as it has a source of energy. In the body, it has that source of energy because it's surrounded by the human body in the womb. In a petri dish, it doesn't. It needs that zap of energy, that electrical energy, to give it the energy, the Planck quanta, to supply the energy momenta to separate the two fields and the fertilized egg into two. From there, the remaining energy keeps repeating the process so long as there's a source of energy for the cells, nourishment and energy for them to continue dividing. So this same process, that's just the explosive energy momenta we started with. You're just adding a bit more to create the explosive spiral, but in this case the spiral just points outwards to separate the physical matter into two identical copies, and then repeats the process over and over and over. In the sun, the opposite happens. The sun is the implosive energy momenta. Matter is drawn in, and in the center of the sun, the electromagnetic fields meet at the point of singularity. And where they meet, they form a pinch, the implosive energy momenta geometry. That pinch acts like a hammer and anvil, for lack of a better term. And what it does is it crushes the topology, just like a hammer and anvil crush an aluminium can. But in this case, they crush it so violently that it doesn't just flatten it. Those topologies fold outwards. When they fold outward, what do they form? They go from being a matter topology into radiant mass energies. The radiant mass energies blast their way out back into space, creating our lovely, bright, burning sun, running from this crushing, this implosion, point singularity in the center of the sun, what I call a gem pinch, a gravito-electromagnetic pinch. It's the reverse of the cellular explosion that creates life and creates the mitosis process. It's the reverse. We're instead of creating matter, we're destroying matter. Matter is not conservative. Mass, energy, momenta, and charge are conservative properties in physics. Matter is not. It's a lot of people assume it is because they swap the word mass for matter all the time in physics because they poorly define it. Not so in tetrionics. We know that matter is a charge topology. It can be created, and it most certainly can and is destroyed, particularly in the heart of stars. It's not destroyed in black holes because, as we've discussed, black holes don't exist. The matter goes into a region of space. It is attracted by the electromagnetic fields, and at that pinch point, the matter is destroyed to release more energy. From our perspective on Earth looking out, what do you see if you see a naked electromagnetic field with no matter? You just see something invisible. It seems to be holding things in place, causing them to gravitate around them, getting closer, spiraling in a vortex fashion, to when it gets to the center of it, then you have a quasar, for example, where any matter that comes in is crushed, its mass energy, a planet worth of mass energy or a star worth of matter is crushed and released as a star's worth of mass energy. Hence, the power source of quasars. But when you look at it, you don't see any physical thing there because you can't see an electromagnetic field unless it's emitting light in prodigious amounts like they do. So all the mechanics of the black hole, the gateway to another dimension because gravity has collapsed so far, are easily accounted for and explained, more importantly, explained by tetrionic field geometries of electromagnetic fields. There are no black holes. There are no white holes. There's no wormholes. No gateways to another universe. No multiverses. Just plain 3D space with changing energy momenta in it, giving rise to the mass, matter, motion, and even time in our universe. So that'll, I think, cover up what we needed to cover in this discussion.
It would be nice if we could. Yeah, wonderful. Oh, yeah, as usual, you go back to the foundation of it all. It's wonderful how you now linked the atomic system to the vortex system and connected the vortex system of the sun, the inward dynamic, and the vortex of the cell, the outward dynamic, into parts of the same description, and also show that at the core of the quantum, that triangular shape basically contains the vortex shape. Let's imagine that it is the rotation of the quantum that will turn on, make us see it as a vortex. We're still talking about the relationship of the cell and music, or the cell and cell rhythms within their context. And specifically in mathematics, it's all about the cell cycles, which of course can adapt. They can go faster, slower, larger, smaller. Thus, the cell cycles are always related to an underlying vortex description. We cannot talk about steady state cell cycles without knowing that, in fact, we are dealing with outward spirals balanced with inward spirals, which together balance out to make the appearance of a steady state circulation, which is also what we see in the organ circulation, which is also what we see in the life cycles, the cycles of nature. There is a relationship of these cycles with the spirals, because as you now have shown very nicely in the images, we can have the top-down view in which we can see it all as concentric cycles or concentric circulations, cycles within cycles, or cell circulation within the organ circulation, within the body circulation, which is part of the circulation of nature. But we also have the possibility to see how that connects to that alternative description which we know as music. Music is not just notes within notes, as we find it in orchestral compositions, but it is also the spiraling of notes with respect to the ground notes which the composer chooses as the core note of any musical composition. And in that sense, there is a relationship between the vortex dynamics which you have described and which you have very neatly connected back to the foundation of the quantum. And of course, there will be a relationship between this understanding of spirals within spirals, which we see in the cells turning inside out in the process of unfolding the first cell in our body to form the whole body, and the equivalent notation that we have, say, a musical composition which starts one note with one note and then unfolds to create this musical composition. But then, as you've nicely shown in Tetrionics 8-2 for the atomic system, the musical composition at some point will have to fold back on itself into the final note of that composition. So there is a direct application of what you have shown for tetrionics and the atomic system to the cell system. As you said in the previous session, we can immediately understand everything that was discussed for the spiral as applying to the vortex. I really needed your explanation to grasp what you were saying, and thank you for the explanation, because that shows again how simple that can be understood in the terminology of tetrionics. We are still dealing with a relationship between, say, zero dimension to one dimension, the vectors of change, yep, to two dimensions, the surface of interactions, of transformations, to three dimensions, the structures that are a result of that. This is very important, because in biology and in healthcare, in the notion of medicine, we cannot look at the body as a real structural system and the foundation of life. It's quite the opposite. In our life, we can see that the body anatomy, which is three-dimensional, is the result of the fractal unfolding of the cells, which is a two-dimensional spiral system, which is based on the turning inside out of the cell in cell division, which is a one-dimensional operation. So in that sense, we can see that the body, the physical body, is only the end result of the physiology, which is only a consequence of the electromagnetic, let's call it the atomic interchanges, which you have now very nicely shown to be a spiral, a vortex turning inside out and south, meeting the other spiral, coming back to the core of the center of the point of inversion, the singularity of the system. So then we have a very clear direct relationship between the atomic system of tetrionics, which is an expansive vortex balanced by an inverting vortex, as a result of which the atoms can keep the whole coherence and maintain the whole coherence that tetrionics can now describe. But that is also the same dynamic which takes place in the cell and biology. And where in the previous sections of mathematics you've made a wonderful connection between the atomic spectra and the, let's call it the chords, the chromatic scales of the cells, here we can actually see that the dynamic of the forces that form the atom are the same as the dynamics that we see operating in the cells. Again, as I described earlier, by the whole constant, whatever we see is supposed to be a scale of light, and thus a quantum scope of atoms, we also see at the equivalent larger scale the version of the same in the range of sound at the scope of cells. And this is what it's like to ask you to improvise, knowing fully aware, being fully aware that for you music is something that you entered into because of my invitation for your participation into this exploration which I already had started with Henk Kooi. Basically combining his understanding of music and health and vocalization, singing of the voice, and healthcare. And with linking that to my understanding that we cannot describe the cellular dynamics of the organic interchanges because of limitations in the terminology of science, chemistry, physics, and so on, the informatics or the logistics of the cell communication we cannot see. Also because, of course, all of it's built and based on the electromagnetic field that underlies it. As there's photon level, there's the electromagnetic level, there's the chemical level, there's the material level, as I always say, but that is basically only the difference between a photon jump, an electron jump, an electron oscillation, and electron bonding. But that is also what we see in the relation between space, time, energy, and consciousness. Space is the level of electron bonding or the standing wave. Time is the level of the electron oscillation or the traveling wave. Energy is the a level of the electron jump or the shock wave. And underlying that all is the level of consciousness or the phase change, which in tetrionics is the inversion going from one side to the quantum to the other, which you have again explained now, is basically the change of charge, which then will lead to a change of energy, which then will create time if it continues. And out of that, if the circumstances and conditions are proper, that can lead to a standing wave, which we will know as a structure in space. Coming back to the anatomy, that's where the anatomy is the consequence of the physiology. The physiology is the consequence of the interfacing system regulation, which takes place in the singularities of the system, which is based on a much deeper level of what happens in the singularity when the polarity changes, let's call it the flipping of the quantum. So there is now a very much more detailed linking between what I was looking for in mathemusics and what you're describing in tetrionics. And knowing that you're still getting into this language of music, basically I would like to ask you to maybe just follow your intuition, basically extending what you've just described for the vortex to what you could understand of what happens in the language, the notation, the performance, and the experience of music. Because those two are all about patterns of frequencies connecting up. It is no different from what you have just described, beautifully linking the atomic system with the vortex and just with that whole core principle of mathemusics. And basically I'd like to ask you to sort of explore what comes up in you, within you, when you look at what you already know about the fields of tetrionics, the forms of tetrionics, specifically the atoms, and what we are discussing now in general, the cells, as the cellular dynamic interaction. Basically that would be the BEM fields bouncing off the CHEM fields in tetrionics, in what that would be in terms of music. Because now we are getting to a much deeper level of understanding, In tetrionics, it's about the relation between the electromagnetic fields, which can interact with the material structures of the tetrions. As a result, on the surface of the tetrions, that will create the kinetic electromagnetic field, the chem field. But it can also lead to a reverberation between the material charged elements and the electromagnetic field known as the Bem field. That means that the chem field and the Bem field are actually the foundation of what we then see now scaled up by the use of the Apollo constant, not at the level of the EM field and the light field, but at the level of sound fields. Basically, I now understand that what music is performing and describing is the equivalent of the chem field and the Bem field in tetrionics. I can imagine that that would be a very lengthy exploration, specifically because in the context of what we are discussing now, of course, my first point of contact would be of what we have discussed before, the note that is maintained but can seem to be expanding or contracting as a result of what people know as the Doppler shift, which in our body people know as elation and depression. But that, of course, can now be described in terms of the dynamic of the vortex. And would you just have a few thoughts on how the vortex and music and health and cells would connect up? And if that would be something to explore in a separate conversation exploration.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, like, it all comes back into that same old thing, that Apollo constant. What's being shown in the physics of the atom and the spectral lines with its chem and Bem fields can be done the same thing to a musical instrument radiating musical notes in a room, but with sound waves instead of musical notes, sound waves instead of spectral lines and colors. It's the same thing. It all relates back down to that omega constant. The Apollo constant that we've spoken about before. The only thing that will change, it'll be the same fields because they're made up of exactly the same quanta. Everything's made up of these triangles. The only thing that will change will be the wavelength and the number of the wavelength of those quanta and the force that they exert, in which case the force would be resulting in the speed of sound rather than the speed of light. And all we then change is a cell instead of an atom, which is just a more complex charge topology. We're getting there already in quantum biology. We've done all the peptides and proteins, and we've done the lipids, the bilayers, etc. So we've got all the components there to make up a cell. We've still got to just work through the DNA, RNA sequence, but that's immaterial to drawing the Bem fields, etc. And then from there, the processes are more or less the same. Add energy, create more force, change the frequency wavelength of the radiant fields, remove energy, slow it down, too much energy with the wrong color coding or the wrong information creates problems for the cell. It either can't process it or it processes the information in entirely the wrong way. Disease versus health. They're all intimately tied up, and it all really revolves around that Apollo constant. It just becomes the similar geometries. All we're changing is the particle at the center. Instead of an atom or a star, we're talking a cell or a human body. The human body has a Bem field, just as hydrogen or helium or any of the elements has a Bem field. A human body in motion has a chem field, just like a particle in motion has. All that's changing is the velocity of motion and accordingly the wavelength of the energy, the wavelength of the linear momentum associated with the energy. So they are all related, and we can probably do a discussion on that. Probably take a bit more time to do up the illustrations, because that's part of the biology book that I'm working on.
Yeah.
Got a whole section on Bem fields, etc. Tie it all back in together. But that's the essence of it. And like what we've discussed tonight with the spirals, etc., exactly the same. All we're changing is what the source is of those spirals, or source of the energy momenta in those spirals.
Yes, and as so often, you've done something very fundamental in again in this conversation, because in healthcare there is this notion of soundness, and it is always used as a metaphoric concept. It in a way led me to the understanding that health and harmony and disease and cacophony are part of that notion of soundness. In fact, 15 years ago or so, I wrote an article on soundness, connecting it back to fundamental principles. But now, soundness becomes something very clear and precise, because it is the atomic physics taking place in the cell, transposed by the use of the Apollo constant. So that soundness is no longer a metaphorical concept, but actually a very literal, let's call it a transliteration of what happens in the electromagnetic field at the atomic levels. Just as you said, what happens at the level of the cells will also happen at the level of the atom, because that's its basis. Maybe you could go a bit into the exploration of that connection between the vortex and orchestral music. Because in my understanding, orchestral music, which of course has a very clear effect on the human body, has the reason why armies use drum bands and stuff to basically mesmerize people into a trance, so that they can unthinkingly do all kind of actions which they later might regret or seemingly rejoice about. Because it has a counterpart, that if you see how sound connects to our consciousness, then we can use that sound to, instead of making war, literally create peace, in the same way that cacophony can create destruction and harmony can create integration. So there must be something very clear about the relationship between what you've just been describing about the vortex, which is the principle of relating the part to the whole, or turning something inside out, or flipping over the quantum, to what music tries to do. And I know I'm in a way pushing the limit of where you've gone with your work in tetrionics, and sort of asking you in a way to overreach into this exploration of music, where you're still trying to find better points of reference and better points of contact. But then, of course, the only way we learn to walk is by being able to take a step beyond where we already stand, to see if we can actually find a new point of balance. As the baby knows, it doesn't matter how we fall, because we can always get up.
Yeah, I think I still have to get more growth going on in understanding music, because my understanding of music is purely an aesthetic thing. I like pop music and tapping my foot, and that it's not restricted to any one genre. But I have no particular understanding of orchestral arrangements and even musical arrangements, musical notation. So it's all on the fly. So I probably have to do a bit more learning and studying to make a qualified statement.
Let me formulate differently. What would you be looking for? What would you be seeking to grasp in order to be able to connect the vortex dynamics which you just described to what seems to be taking place in musical notation?
The way I see it at present, it's straightforward to me. It's simply, just as a star radiates energy from its core, to warm the planet at a suitable distance. It's just perfect, the Goldilocks zone. Same sort of things with musical instruments. The right amount of energy and force and pressure on the strings create, and combination of strings creates the right intensity and musical frequencies that people find enjoyable. And then multiple arrangements of different instruments in the pit create a nice harmonious orchestration that people enjoy. I don't particularly understand or enjoy, for that matter, classical music. I can't follow it, but that's just me. Maybe my brain's just too structured. But the same sort of thing, just as if the sun doesn't emit the right type of energies, and they're not at the right spectral colors, etc., and the right distance, and the planet's not at the right distance, life can't survive. The same sort of thing happens with music, and that's why in the work to date, the way I've played forward with the understanding and the explanations was simply to relate the energy momenta of spectral lines and colors to the energy momenta of the musical notes and chords. And all we've done is said that they're the same geometry because they're made up of the same energy momenta. The difference between colors and notes is simply the wavelength of the colors and the notes. And they're related through that Apollo constant again. So I just purely see it as a particle or an object in the center of a field, and then it's radiating energy momenta. Now, whether it's sound or light makes no difference, because as I said, they're made up of the same things. But the end result to an observer is quite different, because we aesthetically and physically sense and appreciate colours in a different way to what we appreciate musical notes. But they are tied together, in my opinion. They're just related through that wavelength.
Very precisely. You can see that all in the sensory system of our body. It's very nice, in fact, if you look at the details of it, because you can see that all of our sensations of the environment are actually sensations on the surface of the body. We do not perceive light. We do not perceive sound. We do not perceive heat. The only thing that we perceive is that there are frequencies in the environment around us to which specific cells or cell systems are responsive. As I mentioned at other times, the light that we see is basically the angle of approach of a photon or light wave into the rhodopsin of the eye. The sound that we hear is the acoustic wave as it impinges on the drum of the ear. The smells that we perceive are molecular association on the mucosal membrane of the nose, and the tastes are the molecular dissociation on the tongue, which is basically a colony of gut cells. So the only thing that we perceive is vibration, and what is so fascinating about our body is that we have the ability to integrate vibrations from the light spectrum to the electromagnetic spectrum, because of course taste and smell are infrared waves, and then to the sound spectrum, and then to the physical movement spectrum. All of that is integrated within us as a so-called picture of the world around us, but in that sense, as Plato described in his metaphor of the grotto, the only image that we have of the world around us is what we created in the occipital brain at the back of our skull. We don't actually perceive the reality. We perceive an image of reality. And in India, they're very well aware of that. They talk about samsara, which is a sensory impressions of the vibrations on the surface of the body. And they also talk about Maya, which is the interpreted image, the composition within our brain. And evidently, there's no guarantee at all that what we interpret in our brain is actually what's going on around us. But like the people in the grotto of Plato, that is the image that they have, and that is what they can only go by. And so that is also why I try to find a description of health based on what happens within the body rather than on what happens outside of it. Because in healthcare, there's a lot of people who are looking at a kind of cause and effect system, forgetting that the cause needs to be interpreted first, and there can be misconceptions in the interpretations, as a result of which the cause of disease is not in the cause and effect, but in something happening in the translation process in between. So it can be a total internal process, which is actually what we see in many of the psychosomatic diseases, which is actually where spiritual healing is so important, because when people have a misconception about themselves and about the world around them, then evidently they will make an error in computation of what happens and how they can respond to it. The result is that their body will not function in a proper way, and they in a way will rip their body apart from within. And all of the immune diseases are in that category of diseases, which, by the way, is understood quite well in the regulatory system therapies such as acupuncture or homeopathy. And so that's also where it is so important to think in terms of cell communications and cell vibrations, for which the music of the cell cycles is then an excellent metaphor. And then orchestral music, which happens around us, might be helpful for that, for the simple reason that orchestral music is a field of vibrations around the musical instrument, around the orchestra, around the listener, for which there is this very compact notation called the musical score. So in that way, the musical score might be a help to formulate the counterpart of our musical sensation in terms of the cellular communication vibrations. So that is where I was looking for a translation or a transposition of what happens outside us in the sound of music with the music notation, and what happens within us as the song of the cells and our experience of health and diseases. And evidently, as soon as you turn something inside out or outside in, that will operate by the dynamic of the vortex. And that is, of course, why I asked you, can you please help to give some understanding about this principle of the vortex in terms of tetrionics? And I'm very thankful that you did that in this session today, because for me, that is where we can actually see that there is this transition point, this zero point, this point of choice, freedom of choice, where we can connect ourselves as a part into the whole. As I said, this operates at the interface of the system, which is at the level of the cell, the level of the organ capsules, the level of the skin of the body. In fact, any level of boundary or interfacing anywhere in between, but also as outside of that in the electromagnetic field, radio wave fields, and so on. But the pivot of that interaction is always in the system singularity. And any system, whether it be a cell, be an organ, be a body as a whole, there is always a singularity where that boundary turns inside out. And in fact, our body as a whole is a very logical, very consistent, very coherent computational system where all of these singularity points of all of the cells, of all of the organs, of the body as a whole are linked. So when we look at the gut, how with from mouth to anus is basically a vortex hole going through the body, then we can see that that vortex is connected to the organs between themselves, having an organ cycle, which is essentially a series of connected vortices, which in India are known as the chakra system. The chakra and the vortex is exactly the same. The chakra system shows that these vortices of every organ is connected. In the chakra system in healthcare, it is known not as the organs, but as the organ glands, very specifically as the molecular frequencies of the calibrative molecule within that system. And Saskia Bosman has done some very profound research at that level. So in the body we can see that there is this system of vibrations, of vortices, where the system turns inside out. At the level of the organs, we can see that it is a series of vortices all matching up and together creating a larger vortex. At the level of the cell, we then see that thereby every cell is the universe as a whole. So that the principle of generation, organization, and destruction, which we perceive in the universe, are actually also the principle of generation, organization, and destruction in the cell. And I have described that principle as the GOD principle, or the God principle. In fact, it's the principle of integration, generation, organization, and destruction, or the I-God principle. But the basis of that principle of I-God is that of a cell, of a vortex turning inside out on itself. And that is why I'm looking for a relationship between the vortex and that what happens in a cell when it vibrates sound, and you've nicely connected that to what happens in the sun. Earlier you have already described in the sessions on tetrionics that the sun is a vortex with the alpha field determining the interaction between the planets around it. The alpha field is now, in what you described today, directly related to the aufbau of the atom in their three-dimensional organization, which is in fact now related to the vortex. So I assume that there is something in the coherence between the relationship between the star and the musical instrument, or the galaxies and the sound around the orchestra, because at one level we are dealing with a kind of holographic organization of phase fields at the scope of light, while on the other hand we are dealing with the Apollo constant related equivalent of a sound hologram of the wave field of the orchestration of the cells in our body, or the sound around an orchestra in a music hall. And in a way there will be a relationship between the two, and in that sense what you've described for planetary systems and galaxies will inversely apply to health in our body and the sound around the orchestra. And in that sense, just as we find that health in our body is based on the orchestration, the integration, the generation, the operation, and the dissolution of these vortices of the cells turning inside out in our body, there must be something where we can learn from what happens in sound around an orchestra. More interestingly, once we can make that explicit, we can actually model health outside of the body. And that is one of the core ideas in mathemusics, because once we can model health outside of the body, we can also see that we cannot impose frequencies on the body, because that will destroy it. But on the other hand, we can find solutions for internal conflicts in basically calibrating the gears of the vortex system around us, which would be visible then as the vortex systems of sound waves, which we can then understand to be the sound wave around an orchestra in a concert hall. And yeah, maybe you might have some ideas to come up in that conceptualization. Now, because I see that it is already implied in what you have described today, and in fact that's also why I can now formulate that for others to follow, because before I didn't even have enough of a reference system in language outside of us for me to be able to describe what I see inside and what I work with.
Yeah, likewise, I'll have to build up a bit more language, well, and illustrations to go with it too. You've seen the illustrations on the chakra, how it relates back to, again, that atom, strangely enough, but for different reasons, more about the energy levels rather than the chem fields. But it's still, in my mind, it still comes back down to halos of energy momenta.
Exactly.
Whether it's a BEM or an acoustical field, they're just different variations of one another. And the human body, as you say, is just the sensory inputs are just different ways of measuring different frequencies, whether it's mass in the form of matter for taste, or whether it's light frequencies of mass energy, or audible frequencies of sound waves. They're all just about measuring or trying to experience the differing amounts of energy momenta around us. So yeah, it's a logical step for where tetrionics is going to go in the biology stuff, and I hadn't thought of taking it that far, but I suppose you could say in a trite sort of way that it's all about getting the right energy balance in the body, making sense of your environment and seeking out what energies best suit you in order to create a healthy living environment. Explaining it's going to be a bit more than that, because the BEMs of cells interact with each other, which then interact with molecules that interact within the human body, and humans interact with humans. So it's a lot more complex than just a simple field interacting with another one. You've got multiple fields with many different magnitudes of order, of field strengths and energies.
Exactly.
But they all play a role.
Yeah. And that's also
But in some respects, you can reverse it too. You can say that the cell is basically an engineered detection system itself. Whereas we see biological systems, you can view it as antennas, and it's seeking out the best energies, or the most suitable energies, based on the sensors that the cell has to make use of it. And then when it finds that energy, it absorbs it and uses it to create proteins or whatever it needs to create.
Yes, and there's something very fundamental about that, because what you see at that level, the molecular, you also see in the environment. And we can create our optimal environment. Stickleback fish, they can create their nests. Birds do that. Animals can create a territory. Humans are very proficient at actually building houses and building environments, and all too proficient at destroying it too. But in that sense, we can see that we can create our physical environment, but we can also create a communication environment, which in mathematics would be a sound field. But we can also create our mental environment, our interpretation of what goes on around us, which is like a projection screen of our expectation, which is again a light image projected on the contours. But we thereby also create a consciousness field. So whatever we can see for our creation of the physical environment also holds for our creation of the social, the psychological, and the consciousness environment. And that, of course, links to what you're doing in the work on the DNA, that the DNA is like a tuning fork within an electromagnetic field, but that it is in a way not just a carrier of the electromagnetic field, but that it is also the result of the electromagnetic field. As Bruce Lipton shows, it is the information field which builds the DNA and not the other way around. Over billions of years, the information field around the body, around the organs, around the cells, has been the field around the DNA, as a result of which the DNA could be extended. And it is that level where I can see that the sound fields can help us understand how in our body health or harmonics are created, but also disease or disharmonics can be created. And that, of course, means that there is a direct application of that understanding of the sound field of the orchestra to the field of communication of the cells within our body, to the field of consciousness around DNA, and how within the DNA bonds are broken or are built. And that in the DNA, that field around it is just as important as the field that follows from it. And a lot of people forget that we have a psychological, a social field, an ecological field around us, which Teilhard de Chardin called the noosphere, that our sensation of the universe around us is a vibrational field. Schrödinger was very clear about that, also in his book Life. And then it's called What is Life? And once you see that the noosphere is actually that field of vibration of the ecological environment, which in a way gets amplified but also distorted, again, think of health and disease, in the social environment, which of course leads to amplification or disruption of the psychological environment, which is our interpretation of how we relate to environment. But that then leads to the internal consciousness field in the body, which is the bath within which the body, the organs, the cells, but also the DNA are developed. And that is one of the reasons why I'm looking for this metaphor for music, because there we have a language with thousands of years of tradition, with many practitioners who already have an intuitive grasp of the relationship between the musical notation and the somatic, thus the physiological experience. And that is also where it's possible to then build up on the work of Bert Verveen, who says that health is actually based on the continuation of the physiology, which is the cell communication by living cells who are able to decide. So that is where I then found the basis that the physiology is also the psychology, is also the sociology, is also the ecology. But in mathemusics, all of that can be described in terms of musical notation. But musical notation is, let's call it, the equivalent of the aufbau of atoms. It is like tracing different pathway through the atoms, looking at the atom from different perspectives. And that has some authors have done that. All of their books are basically the same idea, but presented from a different perspective. And by understanding that, we can see that trace by the author of having a different perspective on the story is like the spiral, and the idea within us is like the vortex. And there is something in which vortices within vortices are connected to what is seen in the deuteron, which is, say, the core vortex element, but which can build an atom, which is a structure of vortices interlocked and interlinked. But that also is what we seem to see in cell communication. And of that, we seem to experience a variation in orchestral sound dynamics. As I mentioned before, that is where soundness now can be re-understood by tetrionics at quantum atomic importance. And so in music there will be something of a dynamic between vortices, creating a holographic organizational structure, which can be generated, which can be organized, which can be destroyed with the expanding and the contractive spirals, as a result of which the sound field actually is a wave of vortices which together create a hologram which actually defines the soundness of the body and which we can experience as the communication of cells within our body. So you can see that here I'm actually pulling the direct link between the sound field around the body of somebody sitting in a concert hall and feeling better, and the electromagnetic wave field around the DNA as it is created by the cell, which then will structure and restructure the DNA by a dynamic which we find in the sound fields described in Mathe Musics, but which is not at all expressed in the biochemistry of genetic research. For me, there seemed to be a link in how vortices can link up at different scope and scales in what we then experience as, let's call it, the sound field around an orchestra.
Yeah, and it might come down to me reading a few books like that, and like you mentioned with the spirals, where they particularly talk about spirals and vortices, and just applying my understanding of the tetrionic geometries we've just spoke about to try and reimagine or reinterpret what they're saying back into the tetrionic mechanics and the dynamics, and it may prove to be the keys that we need to understand the DNA structure and how it's really working, etc. But there's a lot of work to be done there, because I'm discovering what's being taught and what people think they know isn't quite gelling. Mm-hmm. So there's something missing there yet again. As is always the case with tetrionics, I mean, like every time we come across something that isn't quite explained properly in physics or is presented as a paradox or a mystery of physics, it's because we're not looking at it the right way. So yes.
Yeah.
It's a matter of doing the research and trying to get our head around what the geometry is telling us as to how it's working. Like I say, I mean, like we just had a discussion on BEM fields around matter, etc., around yes. spirals and vortices, and how that can be related back to the periodic atom. But in the same breath, I can also show you the illustration where the chakra is related back to the energy levels. Two different interpretations of exactly the same physical entity, i.e. a periodic element. But two different ways of understanding it and explaining it.
And that's the fascinating,
valid.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the fascination about tetrionics, which is where I compare it to the Swiss pocket knife, that in a way most people learn to write a letter and then learn to write words and then learn to write texts, as a result of which they can write stories. But in this case, the stories which are written are brought back to phrases of different disciplines of science, are then brought back to words as the formulations or the formulae of the different disciplines of science, which then come back to the letters of tetrionics, but they are all now based on one letter, as Stan Tenen described it, the flame letter of the alphabets, that underlying the letter of the letters of the atomic system is the quantum. So now it's all brought back to one unifying factor, as a result of which everything else can fall in place. Yes, that holds for health, and it holds for the chakras, and holds for music, and it holds for the atoms. That's where I find that what you're doing in tetrionics is already so helpful for what I've been looking for in defining the foundation of health in our body, in our being, as human and as humanity. And so your addition to that understanding for Mathemusics in the session of today is again very enriching in simplifying a lot of what people normally work with.
Yep. There's a lot more to go. As we both know, there's biology is such a big, vast field. Trying to explain the mechanics of life is a daunting task. There's so many different facets that go into making it what it is. And we know so little about what's there. And what we do know stuff of, a lot of it's assumptions and extrapolations. And I don't have that luxury. I've got to build with only one thing. Everything I do has to be built from this plank quantum. I don't have the luxury of saying, well, I can draw a fuzzy little picture and assume it works this way. I've got to explain it step by step using those triangles. So the result is you have to put a lot more thought and effort into trying to figure out the actual mechanics, and then just as much thought and effort into drawing up the illustrations of what you think it's work, how it works. So there's a lot more to go, and obviously this is all part and parcel of it, because it all falls within the purview of biology, biological life, and within the scopes of what we're doing with Mathemusics as well.
Yes. And it's powerful how Mathemusics is growing out of what you're doing in Tetrionics.
Tonight's exercise. Yeah, what we did tonight was basically me explaining the physical dynamics of spirals and vortices. What we've still got to weave into that, the biological processes. We only touched on a cell mitosis, and that was it. The rest of it's still this dead matter, or the material stuff, which is what physics is wrapped around.
No.
But as we both know, the physics isn't driven by the matter. The matter is driven by the mass energies, and they're the immaterial part that physics doesn't focus on.
Yeah.
Which is why Tetrionics explains so much, because it's like spraying smoke, I suppose, or spraying paint around to suddenly see fields that we couldn't see before. This hidden component to the physics. And now that we know that the mass energy is there and what shape it is, we can start to understand how it makes things work.
Yeah.
Whereas before, we were just assuming that the breath of life created all these actions.
Yeah, which in a way is right, if you understand that breath is pneuma, or spirit is the electromagnetic field.
But it was a nebulous term.
Yeah, and now that it becomes defined, all of the things which have been explored by that vague concept can be defined also. It's like how many cultures describe it as the dawning of the day, where the mists evaporate and the foggy notions can suddenly become very clear.
Mm.
And that's a very powerful consequence of using Tetrionics, in what I see. Because we are now using it in a couple of the projects that I'm working on. All of them are related to optimizing our experience of health and happiness within us. Some of them dealing with the body, that's the aspect of integral healthcare. Some of them dealing with the environment, which is the project of humanity. And all of it is related to understanding how our consciousness actually determines the decisions that we take, freedom of choice, and how that affects our body, and how that affects our environment. And that's where at some point the connection will be found between freedom of choice and the flipping of a quantum. But much of that already came in place in showing how at a larger level that what happens in the atomic periodic table of elements is a vibrational field, which is now translated to what happens at the level of the cell. And you gave a different perspective on the vortex, basically simplifying a lot of the understanding, and also connecting it up to everything else that is found in tetrionics, and that has an enormous scope of applications.
Certainly has. Yeah.
Yep. At some point, I would be curious if it would be possible to find a notation, formulation, understanding of how vortices form vortex fields at larger levels. I think that is already implied in tetrionics 8-2, the periodic table of elements, because there will be a vortex notation for each of the deuterons and each of the atoms as a result, because that seems to be what's driving the communication of the cells, which are physical structure, but it is the electromagnetic field around them which actually keeps them in place. So the physical cells are in that sense the consequence of the electromagnetic field, in the same way as the DNA is the consequence of the electromagnetic field. And that's also what Lynn Margulis described, that the experience of life builds up our genetic material, not the other way around. It is the information field which is then taking shape as the DNA, in the same way as biologists assume that it was a charge discharge in the primordial atmosphere which created the amino acids. So we shouldn't look for the material as the foundation of the structures of forces that build the universe and the body, but quite the other way around. That's the information fields and the condensation of them that leads to the cells and to the genetic material which the cells then create. So at the level of the understanding of mathematics, those information fields or those radio fields are then addressed by their equivalent of the sound fields, and as sound fields are composed of notes which are now describable as vortices, then an orchestral composition will be a bouquet of vortices all interconnected. And this might be just more than a metaphor. It is very well possible that the flowers are actually, say, the structural equivalent of musical compositions, just spaced out differently in time and connected more structurally with space, because plants are water crystallizing along the force lines of the flow lines of force, which will be the flow lines of a vortex. So there is a lot that started to fall in place due to what you have addressed in this session. And I hope that we can build up on this at some point look into what might be possible to see the relationship between, say, flowers and musical compositions and cells and patterns of communication, say, computer logics. But for now, I think that would be helpful to round this off, because there has been a lot that came into the story. And just to summarize it from my perspective, if it's okay to go to the rounding off for you, then I asked you, can you explain the relationship between the spiral and the vortex? We talked about the spiral in the previous session, because a sustained note and a changing note can be represented by a circle and a spiral. And this time we are still talking about the stable note and a changing note, but now in terms of a vortex. Also connecting that up to the notion of the top view and the side view. So our involvement really matters. And in this episode you put a lot of connections between the vortex and the atomic system as described in tetrionics, while I saw a lot of connections between the vortex and the stabilization of health of the information field within us and around us. it opened up the questions of higher order harmonics, not as musical notes in scales in music as in musical compositions, but also as vortices within vortices, like cells forming the bodies or plant stems unfolding into flowers and other equivalent alternatives in nature. All of them showing that there is this relationship between health, which now has become very explicit in the relationship between soundness to atomic structure connected by the Apollo constant. And thanks again for coming up with that translation constant. So for me, again, this was very helpful, what you contributed to this quest of mathemusics, which is basically the formulation of health in our body and in our lives. As usual, I'd like to ask you to round off this recording session in whichever way you would like to do that.
I think you've pretty well summed it up. I mean, like, obviously, from my perspective, I focused on the explaining two-dimensional spirals as they relate to three-dimensional vortices via the one-dimensional linear momentum or the changing forces. But there's a lot of connections. I mean, like, I keep thinking back to Newton. He was the first one that studied changing force or changing linear momentum as a force, describing it that way. And I find myself coming back to there, because as we do more and more explanations on the role of mass energy, obviously changing mass energy brings about changing momentum, and that's forces. So these are the mass energies are what create matter. They're the things that move matter. They bring about consciousness. So there's a whole suite of things that mass energies do that material matter just can't do by itself. Once it's formed from mass energy, that's it. It's frozen in time. It's just a chunk of mass energy with no idea of what to do. Mm-hmm. All the motions, all the physics come out of the mass energies that surround them. And the ability to relate that back down to musical notes gives us a whole new field of exploration I hadn't even thought of, mainly because I wasn't that au fait with musical theory in the first place. But it's developing quite nicely, so there's a lot of connections to be made, and there's probably a lot more knowledge to come out of it. And the vortices, the spirals, are just one part of it. There'll be many other facets that come about, but they're the dynamic part. They're the part that people are used to visualizing when they're trying to think about these changing momenta, the forces at work. They visualize it as a spiral or a vortices. So now we've got that in place. Hopefully that opens the doors for more explorations and more information to pop out.
Yeah, indeed. And I'm curious about Henk's take on all of this, because then he can certainly help to get us more connected back into music as well.
Yeah. He's been invaluable so far. He's dragged me a long way back into music, where I know things now that I never realized before, never understood.
Thank you for your translations of that new insight in terms of tetrionics. This is where I'd like to close off the recording for now. And as usual, I'll come back to you for evaluation, exploration, what next. Thank you, Calvin.
Yeah. Not a problem.